Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. Today's Wednesday. It's January 19th and 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. I believe we've got a very interesting broadcast for you today. There was one comment on the YonkersTribune.com website which requested to know if someone could call in to the show, and the answer is yes. Listeners are welcome to participate when staying on topic, and we ask all callers who do call to share their first name so that we may refer and address them respectfully by name. And with the topics that we're going to be discussing today, well, at first I'm going to do a review of what's going on in the national, the hyperlocal national and international stage in the first hour. Then at 11 o'clock, we're going to be speaking to Bob Marone. He's a general manager as well as the anchor of Radio Westchester, and we're going to focus with him on hyperlocal concerns. And then at 11:30, I'm very pleased to know that Delphi Musler, he's a publisher and editor of Yonkers Insider, will join us as well from 11:30 to 12 noon. And I'm certain that the focus of his discussion will be on hyperlocal concerns. So let's look at, I guess, some of the most important, compelling stuff that's come about. We had an article that was submitted yesterday by Ron Matten. He's a politician. He ran for Yonkers City Council president in the last election. And so he wrote an article that said that Westchester Power and Community Choice Aggregation, and he wanted to speak about that issue. The last weekend, many Yonkersites received a notice that their energy service provider, or known as an ESCO, E-S-C-O, would be changed unless they choose to opt out. And if they choose to opt out, the simplest way may be to call 914-242-4725, or if preferred, you could do it via hyperlink, which would mean that you would have to go to www.sustainablewestchester.org/WP for White, I guess, White Plains, or Westchester, whatever. So www.sustainablewestchester.org/WP/. Now, this notice was sent to residents with Con Edison accounts who have not entered into a contract with an ESCO and are being supplied utility commodities by Con Edison. Now, if you are a Con Edison customer and you don't remember receiving the notice, you probably threw it away. It looked like junk mail. Your utility bill is divided into two parts. You are billed for the actual utility commodity, which is electricity and or natural gas, and the transmission of said commodity. Now, the transmission or distribution includes the use and maintenance of the transformers, wires, piping, and other infrastructure that Con Edison uses to deliver the commodity. In New York State, consumers can choose their energy provider. In our area, in Westchester County, Con Edison manages the distribution infrastructure, which is often more costly than the commodity. If you did not enter into an agreement with an ESCO or third-party provider, Con Edison is your default provider. Well, the city of Yonkers has contracted with Westchester Power to be the ESCO for residents that currently have Con Edison as their default provider. In order to avoid having your utility provider switched, you must actively opt out before February 9th of this year. If you do not actively opt out, you will be automatically signed up. Current Westchester rates are higher than Con Edison variable rates. You may ask, how can the city of Yonkers change my utility provider without asking me? Well, the New York State Public Service Commission established the Community Choice Aggregation Program on April 21 of 2016. The program allows municipalities to negotiate and procure green, quote-unquote, energy for their residents. A bill sponsored by the City of Yonkers Mayor's Office of Sustainability was presented at the March 9, 2021 City Council meeting. The bill allowed the City of Yonkers to procure energy for all residents who are customers of the default provider, Con Edison. Well, the bill also listed an opt-out provision, not an opt-in provision. The Yonkers City Council passed the bill by a vote of 5-2, and with Anthony Moranti, 6th District, and Mike Breen, 5th District, voting against the legislation, the law is now part of the Yonkers City Code. Now, years before Yonkers joined Community Choice Aggregation, CCA, Greenberg enrolled in the program. Residents of Greenberg have been complaining about the higher rates and the inability to opt out once enrolled. In December, Westchester Power's renewable fixed rate was 33% higher than the average Con Edison standard rate, and this rate is based on Greenberg's published rates. The New York State Public Service Commission requires that municipalities joining the Community Choice Aggregation, CCA, provide education and information sessions to potential CCA members for no less than a two-month period. Yonkers has met this criterion, but the city has done a poor job in promoting the sessions. This is evinced by the large number of residents treating the opt-out mailer as junk mail. While the opt-out mailer and letter displayed the city seal, it came from Houston, Texas, a Houston, Texas address. It did not appear to be an official mailer from the City of Yonkers. City Council and Mayor should delay the enrollment until a new mailer with more appropriate marking can reach Yonkersites. Well, presently, if you do not want Westchester Power to be your ESCO, you must opt out by February 9th of 2022. It's only a few days away. The advantage of being in the program is using energy from renewable sources. The disadvantage is that you will generally pay more for renewable energy. The choice is yours. And just so you know, Ron Matten was raised, he's the author, he was raised and resides in Yonkers. He engaged in a recent effort vying for Yonkers City Council president. So that was a very, very compelling issue with regard to what's going on. And let me just quickly look to see what else we could tell you. This is really important. The Attorney General's abuse of the power of her office was written, is a commentary written by Team Cuomo. Well, this was written on January 18th. Over the last several weeks, more and more information has come out proving what we said all along, that Tish James abused the power of her office to railroad Governor Cuomo so that she herself could run for governor. While her failed campaign lasted only a few weeks, that does not change what her motivation was. Tish James hid from the public that the first accuser witness tampered by threatening to destroy his life if he didn't back up her allegations. Well, Tish James lied to the public when she didn't disclose that the second accuser had a history of colluding with others to make false allegations of sexual assault against a student when at Hamilton College. Tish James falsely credited the allegation of a woman who made the outrageous claim that she was assaulted, only to have the district attorney dismiss the charges, concluding that, quote, after receiving the available evidence, end quote, he, quote, could not secure a conviction, end quote. Well, in fact, four district attorneys have reviewed James' bogus report and concluded what she said all along, what we said all along, meaning the Cuomo team. The law was not broken and no crime was committed. Now, Rita Glavin, the governor's lawyer, held a press briefing last week on this and more, and you could take the time to watch for yourself, and there's a link there. Now, Tish James and Albany politicians abused their offices to do through politics what they couldn't do at the ballot box, remove Governor Cuomo from office. They thought New Yorkers were stupid, but we know better, and we will not give up fighting until the truth finally comes to light. And this was written by Team Cuomo, and they signed it, "Thank you for your continued support and friendship." Well, it needed to be heard. Definitely the former governor has the right to give expression to the circumstances as he sees it. Now, something else on the local market. Are you behind in your rent? Help is available. And in case you're listening and you don't speak English well, hay ayuda disponible. Está usted atrasado en su alquiler y necesita ayuda, which basically means, in English, are you behind in your rent and need assistance? The New York State Eviction Prevention Moratorium ended on January 15, yet help is available. You can reach out to the following agencies for assistance if you are behind your rent and receive the demand for payment or an eviction notice. You can call 211 or visit 211.org. Legal Services of the Hudson Valley is at 877-574-8529. Hudson Valley Justice Center at 914-308-3490. Westchester County Department of Social Services at 914-995-3333. Now, all this is posted on the Yonkers Tribune website. Okay, my Spanish is probably horrendous. However, I will try to do the best I can. So in Spanish, it says, ¿Está usted atrasado en su alquiler y necesita ayuda? La moratoria de prevención de desalojos del Estado de Nueva York termina el, don't know how to say 15 in Spanish, but it's 15 de enero del 2022. Then again it says, comuníquese con las siguientes agencias para recibir ayuda si está atrasado en su alquiler y recibió una demanda de pago o un aviso de desalojo. Llame al 211 or visite 211.org. Legal Services of the Hudson Valley, Servicios Legales. I don't know the numbers in Spanish, but it's 877-574-8529. Hudson Valley Justice Center, Centro de Justicia, 914-308-3490, and Westchester County Department of Social Services, Servicios Sociales, at 914-995-3333. So if you speak a little bit of English and are listening to the broadcast, you probably understood my poor Spanish, but more importantly, you probably understand English. You will find that this is posted on our website. And it's under the label, Are You Behind in Your Rent? Ayuda disponible. ¿Está usted atrasado en si aquí y necesita ayuda? So you'll find that on the website. So I'm sorry for butchering Spanish. I really need to take that up. That'll be my eighth language, no less. But I don't know what the hell I'm going to do and when I'm going to find the time to do all of that. Seems like I'm too busy. I don't know what I'm too busy with, even though I seem to be, my days are filled. I don't know how that happens. And I don't plan it that way. That's the thing that's really frightening. This is very interesting when it comes to politics. A lot of people don't realize this, but it's important. Why there is an increasing number of upset elections. And this is written by Dr. Louis Perron, P-E-R-R-O-N. He's based in Switzerland, in Zurich, Switzerland. So few pundits would have thought a year ago that the German Social Democratic Party will become the biggest party again and that the next chancellor would be from its ranks. during the last French election, the entire political party system collapsed, and an outsider by the name of Emmanuel Macron became president. And as if it were not enough, French voters doubled down. Macron's newly founded party won the absolute majority in parliament. The first reason explaining why there is an increasing number of upset elections is that public opinion is getting increasingly volatile. And Mr. Perron says, I have long observed this during my work in new democracies. It is now true almost everywhere. As public opinion is getting ever more polarized as well, voters increasingly live in their own echo chambers. As a result, mobilization strategies, which often suit the nature of challenger campaigns well, gain in importance. And secondly, I think that voters are increasingly cynical about their political leaders. This means that they are more willing to take a risk and vote for an outsider. And lastly, everything in electoral politics is relative to the competition. Some established politicians have become pretty bad at reaching out to voters and building consensus. In Germany, Armin Laschet ran a terrible campaign pretty much from A to Z. In France, Macron was basically the last man standing after he either self-destructed or did not even run. Well, just so you know, Dr. Louis Perron is an internationally renowned expert in winning elections. He tweets out two takeaways from his campaign about campaigns daily. And you can find him on Twitter at @GR_PERRON. Or you could learn more via his campaign analysis website, which is www.campaignanalysis.com. And he writes in quite a few languages. English, of course, is one, German, and I don't remember if he writes in French as well, but it doesn't matter. English is where most of our readers and listeners would be, so very compelling at that. Now, bear with me a second as I go back here. let me just check if I see this here. One second. Okay, I think that's on the local market. We're good. So let me quickly see where we are here. Okay, we get rid of this particular page and want to go over to see something else here. One second. I've got so many pages open. Want to make sure that we get it all right. This is very interesting from a political perspective. Martin Luther King III has criticized Manchin and Sinema over filibuster reform and says, quote, history will not remember them kindly. Out of Washington, we hear that facing stark criticism from civil rights leaders, senators returned to Capitol Hill under intense pressure to change their rules and break a Republican filibuster that has hopefully stalled voting legislation, hopelessly stalled voting legislation. Bear with me a second here. All right, one moment here. One second, see if I got this right. Maybe I lost the page. Thought I had it, but maybe not. Bear with me. One second. Here it is. Okay, so facing stark criticism from civil rights leaders, senators returned to Capitol Hill under intense pressure to change their rules and break a Republican filibuster that has hopelessly stalled voting legislation. The Senate is set to launch debate yesterday on the voting bill, with attention focused intently on two pivotal Democrats, Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona and Joe Manchin of West Virginia, who were singled out with a barrage of criticism during Martin Luther King Jr. Day events for their refusal to change what civil rights leaders call the Jim Crow filibuster. Martin Luther King III, the son of the late civil rights leader, compared cinema and mansion to the white moderate his father wrote about during the civil rights battles of the 1950s and 60s, a person who declared support for the goals of black voting rights, but not the direct actions or demonstrations that ultimately led to passage of the landmark legislation. Quote, history will not remember them kindly, end quote, the younger King said, referring to cinema and mansion by name. This will be the fifth time the Senate will try to vote or pass voting legislation in this Congress, as election officials warn that new state laws are making it more difficult to vote in some parts of the country. The House has passed the package, but the legislation is stalled in the Senate, opposed by Republicans with a 50-50 split, and Democrats have a narrow Senate majority. Vice President Kamala Harris can break a tie, but they lack the 60 votes needed to overcome the GOP filibuster. Now, once reluctant to change Senate rules, President Joe Biden used the King holiday to pressure senators to do just that. But the push from the White House, including Biden's blistering speech last week in Atlanta, comparing opponents to segregationists, is seen as too late, coming as the president ends his first year in office with his popularity sagging. It's time for every elected official in America to make it clear where they stand, Biden said on Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Quote, it's time for every American to stand up, speak out, be heard. Where do you stand? End quote. Well, the Senate is launching what could become a week-long debate. But the outcome is expected to be no different than past failed votes on the legislation. Biden has been unable to persuade Sinema and Manchin to join other Democrats in changing the rules to lower the 60-vote threshold. In fact, Sinema upstaged the president last week, reiterating her opposition to the rule changes just before Biden arrived on Capitol Hill to court a senator's vote. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, a Democrat of New York, had shelved a promised Monday rules change vote that would have been linked to the King holiday, but He is pressing ahead on Tuesday as advocates push to put senators on record, despite the expectation that no bill will pass this week by week's end. Senators have been working nonstop for weeks on rule changes that could win support from Sinema and Manchin, only to see their efforts repeatedly dashed. The two senators, both moderates, have expressed openness to discussing the ideas, but have not given them their backing. Both Manchin and Sinema have argued that preserving the Senate filibuster rules as they are at the 60-vote threshold to advance legislation is important for fostering bipartisanship. They also warn of what could happen or would happen if Republicans win back majority rule, as is distinctly possible this election year, and could easily pass GOP-backed bills. Sinema came under particularly fierce criticism on social media for invoking King as well as the late Representative John Lewis, whose name is on the legislation despite her refusal to change the rule. Blame also fell to Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell, who is leading his party against the voting legislation. The Kentucky Republican has argued the legislation is a federal overreach into state-run elections, and he harshly criticized Biden's speech last week as, quote, unpresidential, end quote. Civil rights leaders have implored the Senate to act swiftly, as states are passing laws that many argue will make it more difficult for black Americans and others to vote by consolidating polling locations, refusing to allow water distribution in long lines and requiring certain types of identification. We cannot think of a time more defining to the American story than the chapter you are presently writing, NAACP President and CEO Derek Johnson wrote in an open letter to the Senate. What country will your children and grandchildren be left with given the relentless assault on American freedom and democracy, end quote. Manchin spokeswoman Sam Runyon said in a statement late on Monday, Senator Manchin believes strongly that every American citizen of legal age has not only the right, but also the responsibility to vote, and that right must be protected by law. he continues to work on legislation to protect the strike. Well, Sinema's office did not respond to a request for comment. The voting bill was the Democrats' top priority this Congress, and the House swiftly approved H.R. 1 only to see it languish in the Senate. Now called the Freedom to Vote, John R. Lewis Act, the package before the Senate includes some of the most sweeping changes to elections in a generation, including making Election Day a national holiday and requiring access to early voting and mail-in ballots that became overwhelmingly popular during the COVID-19 pandemic. The package is coupled with the John R. Lewis Voting Advancement Act, which would require voting protections that had been stripped by the Supreme Court and would again allow Justice Department scrutiny of states with a pattern of election violations. Unbelievable, to say the least. Oh, for goodness sake. So let me just quickly look here again to see where we are. Okay. Now, one second here. Okay, before we go any further, we need to talk about oil prices. Oil prices hit a 7-year high amid geopolitical instability. The benchmark oil prices climbed to their highest since 2014 yesterday, as possible supply disruption after attacks in the Mideast Gulf added to an already tight supply outlook. Brent crude futures rose 74 cents, or 0.9%, to $87.22 a barrel. Western Texas Intermediate WTI crude futures jumped $1.07, or 1.3%, to $84.89 a barrel. Trade on Monday was subdued because of the U.S. public holiday. Both benchmarks touched their highest since October of 2014, earlier on Tuesday. Supply concerns have risen this week after Yemeni Houthi group attacked the United Arab Emirates, escalating hostilities between the Iran-aligned group, which is the United Arab Emirates, and the Saudi Arabian-led coalition, the Houthis are the ones that are aligned with the Iran, and they were the ones that attacked the United Arab Emirates, which is supported by the Saudi Arabian coalition. Well, after launching drone and missile strikes that set off explosions in fuel trucks and killed 3 people, the Houthi movement warned it would target and it could target more facilities, while the United Arab Emirates said it reserved the right to respond to these terrorist attacks, quote unquote. United Arab Emirates Oil Company, ADNOC, said it had activated business continuity plans to ensure uninterrupted supply of products to its local and international customers. Incident at its Musafa fuel depot. Also adding to geopolitical price premiums are rising tensions between Ukraine and OPEC plus member Russia. In addition, some producers within the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, are struggling to pump at their allowed capacity under an agreement with Russia and allies to add 400,000 barrels per day each month. OPEC will release its January oil market export at 12:30 Greenwich Mean Time, which I don't have the information on that. The consensus is that the situation will not improve in the foreseeable future, and oil demand growth, together with supply constraints, is inevitably leading to a tighter oil balance, said PVM analyst Tomas Varga. Goldman Sachs analysts said they expect oil inventories in OECD countries to fall to their lowest since 2000 by the summer, with Brent oil prices rising to $100 later this year. So, my God, who knows where that's going to go. Now let's look at something else. Major U.S. airlines warned that the 5G expansion could cause chaos for U.S. flights. We'll see if that ever comes about. The chief executives of major U.S. airlines and cargo carriers on Monday warned of an impending catastrophic aviation crisis in less than 36 hours when AT&T and Verizon are set to deploy new 5G service. Well, so nobody knows what's going on here. The airlines warned that the new C-band 5G service can, or was set to begin on Wednesday, which is today, could render a significant number of wide-body aircraft unusable, could potentially strand tens of thousands of Americans overseas, and cause chaos for U.S. flights. Well, unless our major hubs are cleared to fly, the vast majority of the traveling and shipping public will essentially be grounded, wrote the chief executives of American Airlines, Delta Airlines, United Airlines, Southwest Airlines, and others in a letter first reported by Reuters. Well, the Federal Aviation Administration has warned that potential interference has sensitive airplane instruments such as altimeters and significantly hamper low visibility operations. This means that on a day like yesterday, more than 1,100 flights and 100,000 passengers would be subjected to cancellations, diversions, or delays, a letter of caution. So airlines late on Monday were considering whether to begin canceling some international flights that are scheduled to arrive in the United States on Wednesday, with the proposed restrictions at selected airports or transportation industries preparing for some service disruption. We are optimistic that we can work around industries and across industries and with government to finalize solutions that safely mitigate as many scheduled impacts as possible, plane maker Boeing said on Monday. Action is urgent, the airlines added in the letter, also signed by UPS Airlines, Alaska Airlines, Atlas Air, the cargo company, JetBlue Airways, and FedEx Express. To be blunt, the nation's commerce will grind to a halt, end quote. The letter went to White House National Economic Council Director Brian Deese, Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, FAA Administrator Steve Dixon, and Federal Communication Commission Chairwoman Jessica Rosenworcel. Airlines for America, the group that organized the letter, declined to comment. The FAA said it will continue to ensure that the traveling public is safe as wireless companies deploy 5G. The Federal Aviation Authority continues to work with the aviation industry and wireless companies to try to limit 5G-related flight delays and cancellations. And the other government agencies did not comment either. AT&T and Verizon, which won nearly all of the C-band spectrum in an $80 billion auction last year on January 3rd, agreed to buffered zones around 50 airports to reduce interference risks and take other steps to cut potential interference for 6 months. They also agreed to delay deployment for 2 weeks until Wednesday, temporarily averting an aviation safety standoff after previously delaying service for 30 days. Well, Verizon and AT&T declined comment on Monday. They argue that C-band 5G has been successfully deployed in about 40 other countries without aviation interference issues. The CEO of major airlines and Boeing chief executive Dave Calhoun held a lengthy call with Buttigieg and Dixon on Sunday to warn of the looming crisis, officials told Reuters. Well, United Airlines late on Monday separately warned the issue. More than 15,000 of its flights, 1.25 million passengers, and snarled tons of cargo annually. United said it faces, quote, significant restrictions on 787, 777, 737, and regional aircraft in major cities like Houston, Newark, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Chicago. The airlines ask, quote, that 5G be implemented everywhere in the country except with the approximate 2 miles of airport runways at some key airports. Immediate intervention is needed to avoid significant operational disruption to air passengers, shippers, supply chain, and delivery of needed medical supplies, they said. The airlines added that flight restrictions will not be permitted to or will not be limited to poor weather operations. So that's where we stand with regard to that. We'll see where all that goes. Now, just bear with me a second here. one second. Okay, well, evidently the Saudis have gotten it together. A Saudi-led coalition airstrikes target Yemen's Houthi rebels after the Abu Dhabi attack. Saudi-led coalition fighting Yemen's Houthi insurgents on Monday said it had launched airstrikes targeting the rebel-held capital of Sana'a following a deadly attack against Abu Dhabi that killed three and was claimed by the rebels. In response to the threat and out of military necessity, airstrikes have begun in Sana'a, the official Saudi press agency said on Twitter, a few hours after the United Arab Emirates vowed reprisals. Well, the Houthis' Al-Masira TV channel confirmed the raids by the coalition. One airstrike killed about 14 people in a single building at the Yemeni capital of Sana'a, residents said on Tuesday. Coalition strikes around the city had killed a total of about 20 people, the Houthi deputy foreign minister said on Twitter. The United Arab Emirates is a part of a Saudi-led military coalition that supports Yemen's government against the Iran-backed Houthi rebels who have repeatedly targeted Saudi Arabia with cross-border strikes. But Monday's attack by the Houthis was the first deadly assault on Emirati soil acknowledged by the United Arab Emirates and claimed by the rebels who said they had fired ballistic missiles and deployed armed drones. Well, two Indians and a Pakistani working for oil giant ADNOC died as three petrol gas tanks exploded near a storage facility while a fire also ignited in a construction area at Abu Dhabi Airport in the heart of the United Arab Emirates, a renowned safe haven in the volatile Middle East. Well, police said that small flying objects, possibly belonging to drones, were found at both sites. Drone attacks have been the hallmark or a hallmark of the rebels' assault on neighboring Saudi Arabia. Quote, we condemn the Houthi terrorists, militias, targeting of civilian areas and facilities on United Arab Emirates or soil today. This sinful targeting will not go unpunished, United Arab Emirates Foreign Minister Abdullah bin Zayed Al Nahyan said in a statement, as his ministry described the attack as a, quote, escalation, end quote. Houthi military spokesman Yahya Sari said that they had carried out a successful military operation against important and sensitive Emirati sites and installations using both ballistic missiles and drones. Well, the incident followed a surge in fighting in Yemen, including advances by United Arab Emirates trained troops. The rebels also seized a United Arab Emirates flagship and its international crew earlier this month. Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Qatar, and the Organization of Islamic Cooperation all condemned the terrorist attack, end quote. And eight Houthi drones targeting Saudi Arabia were also intercepted, the coalition said. Other countries, such as the United States, Russia, and France, as well as the United Nations, have also condemned the attack on Emirati soil. The rebels have previously threatened to target Abu Dhabi and Dubai. The gleaming crown jewels of the United Arab Emirates, which last year opened its first nuclear power plant. There's a clear warning here. Abdul Ilah Hajjah, advisor to the president of the Houthi Supreme Political Council in Sana'a, said it was a warning shot from the rebels. We sent them a clear warning message by hitting places that are not of great strategic importance, but it is a warning if the United Arab Emirates continues its hostility to Yemen and will not be able in the future to withstand the coming strikes. Saudi Arabia's foreign ministry condemned in the strongest terms the cowardly terrorist attack, while Bahrain and Qatar also slammed the strikes. The incident comes 2 weeks after the rebels hijacked the United Arab Emirates flagged Rawabi, the released footage supporting to show military equipment on board. United Arab Emirates said the Rawabi, whose 11 crew are now hostages, was a civilian cargo vessel and called the hijacking a dangerous escalation in the busy Red Sea shipping route. Well, the rebels later rejected a United Nations Security Council demand for the ship's immediate release, saying it was, quote, not carrying toys for children but weapons for extremists, end quote. Well, Yemen's conflict has been a catastrophe for millions of its citizens who have fled their homes, with many on the brink of famine in what the United Nations calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Yeah, but when people die, they don't give a hoot one way or the other as long as they can fight their politics. The United Arab Emirates joined the coalition against the Houthis before announcing a change of tack in 2019. The pro-government giant brigade troops, backed by the Saudis and United Arab Emirates, recently delivered a significant blow to the rebels by recapturing three districts in Sabwa or Sabwa. Clashes were part of an upswing in violence in the shattered country where the war is being fought on several fronts. Unbelievable, the sort of stuff that goes on in the world stage. And unfortunately, too many of us don't realize it. Now let's look at what's happening in the United Kingdom. Frightening what's going on there. In the name of God, go! That's what the United Kingdom's Johnson faces demands to resign. Well, out of London, we hear that the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson on Wednesday dismissed calls to resign from opponents and some of his own lawmakers fighting to save his premiership amid a deepening revolt against his party over a series of lockdown parties in Downing Street. Johnson, who in 2019 won his party's biggest majority in more than 30 years, is now fighting to shore up his authority after a series of revelations about parties in his Downing Street residence during COVID-19 lockdowns. Johnson has repeatedly apologized for the parties and said he was unaware of many of them. Well, however, he attended what he said he thought was a work event on May 20, 2020, to which staff has been told to bring their own booze, quote unquote. Johnson said on Tuesday that nobody had told him the gathering was against COVID rules, like as if he needs to know. I expect my leaders to shoulder the responsibility for the actions they take, Brexit-supporting conservative lawmaker Davis had told Parliament. Davis cited a quote from a conservative lawmaker, Leo Amery, to then Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain over his handling of war in 1940. Quote, "You have sat there too long for the good you have done. In the name of God, go." End quote. Asked directly by an opposition lawmaker if he would resign, Johnson said no. Toppling Johnson would leave the United Kingdom in limbo for months, just as the West deals with the Ukraine crisis and the world's fifth largest economy grapples with the inflationary wave triggered by the COVID pandemic, with the United Kingdom inflation rising to the highest level in nearly 30 years. Well, to trigger a leadership challenge, 54 of the 360 conservative ministers of parliament in parliament must write letters of no confidence to the chairman of the party's 1922 committee. Implored to stay by one supporter, Johnson said he had not yet, quote, sat here quite long enough, indeed nothing like long enough, end quote. As many as 20 conservative lawmakers who won their seats at the last national election in 2019 planned to submit letters of no confidence to Johnson, the Telegraph, the newspaper, reported. A handful of others have already said that they had written such letters. An analyst by the Times newspaper that's based out of London, not the New York Times, the London Times, is known as the Times, showed that 58 conservative lawmakers had openly criticized the prime minister. Leading rivals within the Conservative Party include Chancellor of the Exchequer Rishi Sunak, 41, and Foreign Secretary Liz Truss is 46. It's called a pork pie revolt. Downing Street lockdown parties, some held when ordinary people could not bid farewell in person to dying relatives, have undermined Johnson's authority. Johnson on Tuesday denied an accusation by his former advisors he had lied to Parliament about a lockdown party, saying nobody had warned him the, quote, bring your own booze gathering might contravene COVID-19 rules. As he waded through the empty bottles and platters of sandwiches, he didn't realize it was a party. Does the Prime Minister realize how ridiculous that sounds? Keir Starmer, the leader of the opposition Labour Party, told Parliament. Every week, the Prime Minister offers absurd and frankly unbelievable defenses to the Downing Street parties, and each week it unravels. Starmer, who welcomed the defection of lawmaker Christian Wakeford, who earlier on Wednesday led Johnson's Conservatives to join Labour, asked Johnson if a Prime Minister should resign if he had misled Parliament. Quote, my decision is about much more than your leadership and the disgraceful way you have conducted yourself in recent weeks, Rayford said. I can no longer support a government that has shown itself consistently out of touch with the hard work of the Bury South and the country as a whole. Support for Johnson and his party has plummeted after a series of revelations about the parties and other missteps. His own former spokeswoman resigned after she was captured laughing and joking on camera about how to cast a Christmas party if asked about it by reporters. Such was the revelry in Downing Street at one event that staff went to a supermarket to buy a suitcase of alcohol, spilled wine on carpets, and broke a swing used by the Prime Minister's young son. The Mirror said staff had, said that staff had bought a wine fridge for Friday gatherings, events that were regularly observed by Johnson as he walked to his apartment in the building. Johnson has given a variety of explanations of the parties, ranging from denials that any rules were broken to expressing understanding for the public anger at apparent hypocrisy at the heart of the British state. He said people must wait for the outcome of an internal investigation by a senior civil servant before reaching conclusions. Opponents have portrayed him as a charlatan who demanded the British people follow some of the most onerous rules in peacetime history while his staff partied. The growing internal conservative rebellion was cast as the pork pie plot because one alleged rebel lawmaker was from Melton, the home of the Melton Mowbray pork pie, and pork pie is also London's slang for a lie. So now you've heard it. Pork pie means a lie. In case you go to the United Kingdom, now you know what to say and when to say it. 1 second. All right. Now, let's say we've got just a little bit more time before our next guest comes on. So we'll see what goes on there. Bear with me a moment. 1 second. This is probably the most thing of situations. Evidently, Blinken vows, quote, relentless, end quote, diplomacy to avert a Russian attack on Ukraine. Evidently, Blinken says that Russia could attack Ukraine at short notice. The Kremlin says arms deliveries to Ukraine increase tension. And Blinken is to meet Russia's Lavrov in Geneva on Friday. So out of Kiev, this is what we hear. The U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said on Wednesday that Russia could launch a new attack on Ukraine at very short notice, but Washington would pursue diplomacy as long as it could. On a visit to Kiev to show support for Ukraine, the top U.S. diplomat said Ukrainians should prepare for difficult days. He said Washington would keep providing defense assistance to Kiev and renewed promise of severe sanctions against Russia in an event of a new invasion. The Kremlin said the tension around Ukraine was increasing and it was still waiting for a written U.S. response to its sweeping demands for security guarantees from the West. The pessimistic statements highlighted between Washington and Moscow as Blinken gears up for a meeting with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov on Friday that a Russian foreign policy and analyst called, quote, probably the last stop before the train wreck. Blinken promised, quote, relentless diplomatic efforts to prevent renewed aggression and to promote dialogue and peace, end quote. He said a Russian buildup of tens of thousands of troops near the Ukrainian border was taking place with, quote, no provocation and no reason, end quote. Quote, we know that there are plans in place to increase that force even more on very short notice, and that gives President Vladimir Putin the capacity also on very short notice to take further aggressive action against Ukraine, he said. He did not spell out how quickly Russia might move. Independent security analysts say they do not believe Moscow has so far assembled the logistics and medical units it would need to launch an immediate attack. Russia has also moved troops to Belarus for what it calls joint military exercises, giving it the option of attacking neighboring Ukraine from the north, east, and south. Well, it continues to deny any such intention. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said that Western weapons deliveries to Ukraine, military maneuvers, and NATO aircraft flights were to blame for rising tension around Ukraine. Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba accused Russia of trying to sow panic in Ukraine. He said diplomacy offered the only way out, and it was, quote, an indestructible principle, end quote, that no decision about Ukraine could be taken without its involvement. The basic principle is simple. A strong Ukraine is the best instrument to restrain Russia, he said, yet hopes are dim. The United States say that Russia is threatening its post-Soviet neighbor and may be poised for a new invasion 8 years after it seized Crimea and backed separatist forces who took control of large parts of eastern Ukraine. Russia says it feels menaced by Kiev's growing ties with the West. It wants to impose, quote, red lines to prevent Ukraine over joining NATO and to get the alliance to pull back troops and weapons from Eastern Europe. Oh, one second. I don't know what that is, but unfortunately, I need to answer that. So bear with me a moment. One second, sorry about that. All right, forgive me. I guess it's better than interrupting our guests. One moment. All right, let's see. Well, in the meantime, I could talk to you by telephone. 1 minute. I sometimes have medical deliveries, and I didn't know that one was coming today. Well, let's see. At 11 o'clock, we're going to be speaking to Bob Marone. And then 11:30, Delphi Musler. So that should be interesting, and we'll be talking more about local stuff than anything else. Bear with me a moment. Here they are.
Thank you so much. I'm sorry for the delay of bringing you in. Thank you.
You too. Sorry. Bear with me a moment. Got to pull this in. All right. Oh, for goodness sakes. Goodness. Well, let's see. All right, we've got a couple of minutes. Okay. Before 11 o'clock. Okay. Not as agile as I used to be. One moment. I didn't really expect them today, but it is what it is. All right. Let me just quickly look. All right. So we know what's going on there. And let me just check to see if anything else is happening. I don't know where I was before, but all right, we have to do this. Let me see what else we've got here. All right. Sorry about that. Oh, this is interesting. I didn't see this before. But I think I've got enough time to read this to you. This is a... oh, no, this is something else. Sorry. Okay. No, that's not what it was. I got the wrong page. Let me just see if we've got anything else we need to do here. There might be. I'm not sure. Let me quickly see here. All right, my goodness. Oh, this is really quite interesting. This is all new. And a U.S. tycoon is going to open up Africa's first start-to-finish COVID-19 inoculation plant. Wow. U.S. biotech billionaire Patrick Soon-Shiong today opened a plant in Cape Town, that's in South Africa, that will be the first in Africa to produce COVID-19 vaccines from start to finish. Very exciting. The factory should churn out its first vials of second-generation coronavirus vaccine, quote, within the year, and produce 1 billion doses annually by 2025, Soon-Shiong had said. The plant will be South Africa's third COVID vaccine manufacturing facility, but the first in the continent to make the formula across every stage rather than producing it from semi-finished batches. With just 10.9% of the 1.3 billion people fully vaccinated, Africa is the least vaccinated continent in the world. This compares with approximately 63% in the United States and around 70% in Europe. Africa currently manufactures less than 1% of all vaccines administered on the continent, according to the World Health Organization. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa, speaking at the inaugural event, hailed the plant as a sign of African self-reliance. Quote, Africa should no longer be the last in line to access vaccines against pandemics. Africa should no longer go cap in hand to the Western world begging and begging for vaccines, Ramaphosa had said. Quote, we will stand on our own, end quote, he vowed, continuing, end quote, without the shackles of colonial thinking, end quote. He thanked Soon-Shiong, a South African-born and now United States-based doctor turned entrepreneur, for returning, quote, home, end quote, to invest in vaccine production. Born in South Africa to Chinese parents and now a U.S. citizen, the billionaire said the launch was, quote, one of the momentous moments of my life. This is a homecoming. How wonderful. Unbelievable. After making a fortune by inventing a cancer drug, he founded NantWorks, NantWorks, a California-based startup in healthcare, biotech, and artificial intelligence in 2007. Production at the state-of-the-art vaccine manufacturing campus in Cape Town's Brockengate industrial area will be a collaborative effort between NantWorks, South African research institutions, and four local universities. We have now developed this SN, or spike nucleic T-cell vaccine, a second-generation vaccine, and we want to manufacture this in Africa for Africa and exported to the world, Soon-Shiong had said. The vaccine is being developed, quote, all the way from scratch, end quote, with self-amplifying RNA, ribonucleic acid, drug substance to full finish, the doctor had said. Johnson & Johnson has an operational fill-and-finish plant in South Africa, and Pfizer-BioNTech have partnered with BioVac to bottle their mRNA vaccine starting this year. Quote, we want to migrate from just doing fill and finish to wanting to manufacture the drug substance ourselves, Ramaphosa had said. Meantime, the South African biotech, a South African biotech consortium is working on a pilot project to tweak Moderna's mRNA formula and prototype shots could be available for trial this year. South Africa and India have been lobbying the World Trade Organization to temporarily suspend intellectual property rights so that COVID-19 vaccines are accessible to poorer countries. Well, the Billionaires Family Foundation, along with the Rockefeller Foundation, the United Nations National Institute of Health and European Commission, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation have raised more than 1 billion rands, that's $65 million, to fund the project. Sun Xiong says that another $195 million will be needed to be raised to develop a new plant, which will also produce cancer vaccines. The NantWorks project will also work on cell-based immunotherapies that could lead to new cancer vaccines and treatments. What unbelievably wonderful work. And I see that our next guest is already online and I'm late to the party, so bear with me. Good morning, Mr. Marone. How are you? I'm sorry for my delay. Hello?
Oh, my ear hit me.
Maybe something happened.
My apologies.
Hello?
Hello? I wasn't sure what happened.
Am I coming through?
Are you okay?
Yeah, I'm good.
Yeah, you're coming through.
My ear hit
the... We're speaking to Bob Marone. He's the general manager and anchor of Radio Westchester. So good morning. Thanks for calling in.
Well, it's my pleasure. It's absolutely my pleasure.
I wanted to ask you, you know, you're staying in touch with what's going on in Westchester County overall.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the most significant thing that you recognize now? What's the talk of the town in New Rochelle or in Mount Vernon or in Yonkers or upstate in Yorktown? What strikes you as most pertinent? Or maybe what's happening in local government here in Westchester County?
Well, TG, there's always so much. I think the thing that's surprising me, like take a look at New Rochelle for a moment. Do you know when I had my last location for my radio station just before COVID hit, we had passed through a year where 28 different developers had been given clearance. Now it's up to 30-something. To build high-rises, and to build high-rises that were mostly rental. And rentals, not co-ops. I mean, there's a few. But the interesting thing, Hezzy, is that the skeptics were wrong. And I wouldn't say that I was skeptical, but I had a healthy sense that, geez, can we really fill all these buildings? And so New Rochelle is becoming a skyscraper city with still more to come development. And it's continuing, I wouldn't say unabated because it seems to have an end cycle in the next year or two. But we went from a city that had a little downtown, nice little skyscrapers, you know, the Trump Tower was there and some other buildings. But people are taking advantage of the fact that it's 45 minutes from Manhattan. And they're moving into these buildings. I didn't think they would move in at this pace. And I guess, and this may have to do with the fact that I'm not a youngster anymore, although I stay on top of things. Young people like that lifestyle. They like the apartment lifestyle. They, even though the rents are high, I mean, most people's mortgages, unless you live up to
the houses are higher. Housing, you know, private homes are much more expensive.
Well,
it's a question of affordability, isn't it?
Well, it's a question of affordability. It's also a question of how much do you have for the down payment and taxes. For example, I mean, if you look at these apartments, a one or two bedroom is upwards of anywhere between $2,500 and $4,000. And that's a rental.
You're just not used to it because you're an old man, but the bottom line is these are the going rates. And what's more important than the rates is the fact that New Rochelle has a patina and a name that is well respected in the entire metropolitan area, and that people are thinking of moving into New Rochelle, and there's a lot going on in New Rochelle, and that's what's exciting. But every community has to evolve. And it doesn't matter if they're 45 minutes from New York because people are not going to New York to work. They're working out of their home.
That's true. And I think apropos of what you said it more bluntly, as is one of your gifts, I am an older guy.
Than you.
No, I know, you miserable old critter.
Thank you.
But seriously, that is a part of it because, yes, for us in our lifestyle, well, gee, if I'm going to pay $3,000 a month, I'm going to own a home. Young folks are less concerned, and they are more concerned about lifestyle. New Rochelle is also building a lot more things to do, if you will, from cultural centers and things like that. But the news about it is that despite the skeptics, and I wasn't one of them, I like the idea, but there's another, I have to go there. I wouldn't be an honest journalist. You know, New Rochelle also has, as do all cities, but has a significant amount of poverty in the West End and parts of the East End. And while as a city it doesn't have a crime, if you take a look at the strip that is Lincoln Avenue and outward from that, going, I guess you would say, southwest, there's a lot of crime there. And it has a lot of poverty. For example, even when I was applying for a grant for my radio station that was closed by COVID, in order to get the grant, you have to show that your business was in an area at a certain amount of poverty, and it is, and it was. So it's not a perfect city, but in that sense, it is a city. And perhaps what even you miss because of your age, as in mine, is the fact that these people that are moving into the city are moving into the downtown. They're moving into what I like about the city is its most diverse area, which is the downtown. It's a cultural melting pot. And the train station's pretty close to all these buildings. They're not likely to need a car. But that's news to me. It's news because we had, I'd say, and here again, age shows. When you and I were doing a lot of shows together back on WVOX, and I was covering the news every morning, there was enormous pushback to even that modest sprinkling of new buildings 15 years ago. Enormous. Most of the callers, but we liked it when it was like.
Yeah, but times have changed. Times have changed, and people have to get on with life. And the point is that the city can't survive by languishing the way they were 15 years ago. And
that's correct.
So that's what's important. And what's important, too, is, and this is, you talk about the poverty, and every community, whether it's a town or a city or a village, has a smattering or even a large population that could be considered or designated to be poor and are challenged. They don't have a good employment for whatever, a million and one reasons. However, the city also assists some of these people. If we get more people who are willing to spend $2,500, $3,500, $5,000 for a rental, that means that there'll be more money coming into the economy. And the city of New Rochelle will be able to some way, subsidize some of the things that it wants to do, such as attract even affordable housing, at a level where a developer who wants to do that can do that.
Mm-hmm.
And everything is going to rise up. It's not going to be a two-story building anymore. That's out. It's out the door.
I like that. And I agree with you. The other thing, and this is in New Rochelle, but it sprinkles to Westchester, and it goes back a few years now, is, of course, New Rochelle, like most of Westchester, except say maybe Eastchester and some other areas, is a blue city. And what's evolved here in
what
Westchester...
What do you mean by a blue city? What does that mean?
Democratic. Democratic and liberal.
Oh,
but
okay.
There has been a turn... for good or ill, I'll let others decide that. I have my own opinions, and they're still forming in some cases, to the very hard left. And one of the things I've observed, now this is an observation, and I covered it in the news when I was doing that kind of news, there is a certain, and I understand something, a lot of it has to do with making it a sanctuary city and not calling people on their citizenship. But one of the if you will, extracts from that has been an unwillingness to deal with things like people that drive without licenses, people who are taking these
motorcycles.
That's
not specific to New Rochelle. You know, No, I mean, that's the entire country.
Yep.
Well, not everywhere is that.
Yeah, but they don't do anything about it. They you know, in other words...
Oh, welcome to the world. Welcome to the world. Most people are appeased by... Oh, it's a law. Really? And who is enforcing it? Probably not, most people don't. However, the only way you're going to get things to change is if people speak up. And there are organizations that are there that do protect the rights of people who are not registered or don't have a license. And it shouldn't be taken for granted just because you feel you want a car that you can drive when you don't have a driver's license.
Well, that's true.
Who's responsible for that?
But they're not being enforced. Government is. A government that has pushed a little too far to the left, in my view. If someone
That's your view, but the point is that's the way the nation is going.
No, I understand. But you've asked me what are the things that I've noticed, you know, what are the trends here in New Rochelle or
but
in
the county?
But it's
not New Rochelle. It's not New Rochelle.
But the whole
it's
country, I wouldn't say the whole country has moved hard left. I would say
no.
A lot of the inner cities have, and they've gone to excess in a way that hurts what I believe is a larger cause, which is to stop the attack on democracy that Trump and the hard right represents, and I think it's going to kill the very things that they are trying to change.
Who's trying to change what?
Okay.
I don't understand.
You've got the hard left that doesn't believe in prosecuting many crimes now. And a lot of people are being let go with probation rather than incarceration.
Okay.
Now, full disclosure, I work for an organization now by contract that helps people who go out on patrol and tries to keep them out of jail with the best of intentions. So it's a slippery slope, but I need to go there. But as a society, if we are not going to punish crimes because of things that have happened for the last 100 or 200 years and say that it's, I mean, while there's an element, while there's racism needs to be separate from when you cross a line or not. Whether or not there has been systemic racism, even in the way that the far left would prescribe it, if you kill someone, it's a crime. If you break into a store, it's a crime. Now, there are ways to deal with it, but those ways to deal with it, even though they may change, they need to be effective. We can't have people back on the streets and find out that they killed someone, and this is the 101st time that they've been arrested. And this is where the far left is going to find itself.
You know what? People are just trashing society. It takes time to move a big vessel as like the United States, and we need to be patient. You may not be patient if you're at the wrong end of the equation, but there's nothing that we can do. But when people get arrested and get jailed for the stuff that they do, killing people because of the color of their skin or however it was defined. But we've had a lot of issues like that. People wake up because maybe the law has been porous quite often and it has been blind to what's going on. It's no longer blind. And whatever happens in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, not that anything ever did because I would know, or in Newark, New Jersey, or in New York City, or in Maine, it doesn't matter. But we have a press, and we have a news cycle that spits it all out. And if you're uninformed, then you're uninformed. But you can read in Spanish, you can read in English, you can read in a million and one other languages. And you could also see everything on the internet if you have it. And you can also translate everything you see. Hey, I did part of my section today because today there was a notice from the government that if you needed help because you were being evicted and you were behind on your rent, whatever, I even read it in Spanish. I don't know how many people who are on the radio show are listening to me in Spanish when that's all they understand. Probably unlikely, but just to make people feel comfortable in case they have a friend or somebody that wants to read it, In broken Spanish, I read what needed to be read. I hope I didn't butcher the language. I need to learn it, but whatever.
No, that's all right. You'd make a good butcher. I'll take two center cut steaks.
Thank you.
I hear everything you're saying, and the disappointment is the numbers of people who don't read other than what they want to hear or who aren't aware of the laws. No, the concern that I have...
But that changes over time, doesn't it change over time?
No, I do understand
that.
Well,
where were
we
10 years ago? And where were we 20
years
ago?
In some ways, we were better off. In most ways, we weren't better. I mean, it depends on...
In what ways were we better off 20 years ago? In what ways were we better off 20 years ago? We weren't.
Okay. We didn't have the angst in this country over the
nobody
fact
cares
that
about your angst or my
teetering.
Angst.
Nobody no,
cares
but I think
that.
We care. Yeah, well, but people care about national angst because it's driving the country apart more than it ever has been since before the Civil War.
Well, you have a legitimate point, except that you're not going to change the equation, and neither will I, unless you vote.
You know what?
However
I know
you feel
that.
To vote, and I will vote
you know
how
what?
I feel I need to vote. And if people don't want to wake up, then tough. It's just
no, I
tough.
Know, Hezzy. I know, Hezzy.
You,
but can't, even last
you
night,
can't preach it to death. Not you.
No, but I'm
but
no,
can't
no,
preach.
No, I understand. Let me just tell you where my own personal angst comes from.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Quite frankly, other than a few people that listen to me on the radio, And even then, it's an intellectual bit of discourse. No one gives a shoot about what Bob Morone thinks about these things or that it bothers him.
Yes, they do.
As you suggest, the tide has to grab hold of the population. It needs, you know, kind of like a Ouija board. The notion of America and the awareness of people needs to bring along in a tide the awareness of what's really going on throughout all the BS. And I'll read it like you. You know, I read all the columns. I read all the
opinion
pieces.
You got to look at the progression in America. When I came to America, it was one country. It's now completely different. There was a time where there was a lack of sensitivity and interest, or rather disinterest, in what was happening with Black America. Everybody spoke a good game, and every second word was Martin Luther King, and all these sort of things. But you know what? We knew very little, and we hardly changed. When it came to the Hispanic community, they did a better job than African Americans in America. What they did was they told us what the life that they had to lead here. They were invited into the country. They didn't come across the border like they do now, but they're not necessarily Hispanic because they come from all over the world through South America to get across the border illegally. And at that time, they basically came in legally. The point is that they told us their story. And even though they spoke in a different language, it became part of our comprehension and our understanding. Not everyone to the same extent. The African-American community has been silent for too long because they never took the issue up on their own. Maybe they were afraid that they would be put down or ostracized or they would lose their job. But you know what? The same situation took place with the Hispanic community, and it didn't matter where you came from. You know, you spoke Spanish and so on and so forth. You think people coming from Africa today feel better because they're Africans when they don't even look like African Americans? They don't speak. They don't have the same. Their language is different. Their culture is different. Their faith is quite often different. They cook differently. Their culture is completely different. These are people that if you never bumped into them, you don't know who they are. I've traveled the world. I've been to Africa and more places than people know there were countries. I've been to Asia countries and Muslim countries invited by governments, not because I decided I wanted to take a tour. I was invited to there. They had to pick me up from an airport because when the dictator from Pakistan, maybe 30 years ago, invited me to come and help him do what they needed to do in Pakistan. A guy by the name of Al-Haq Zia, a real butcher. And the bottom line is he invited me to help him put together a travel program. And I said to him, well, I'm coming in with my Israeli passport, so don't mess with me. And I said, if you want me, I want a letter from you telling whoever is going to arrive when I arrive in Karachi Airport that you're there to invite me, because I'm bringing in my passport. I don't have anything else to travel on. You know, but the bottom line is that's how I came. And guess what? Even with his letter, it took him 6 to 7 hours for them to arrive. And then it was the president's car that picked me up.
Hey, this is the world. If I may turn this around, when you were traveling in those days, were you traveling as a journalist or as a businessman?
No, I was a businessman. I was in the travel business. What I did was I created a niche in the travel business, and that was to bring adults of my age or even younger or even older, as long as you were able to walk and move about, even if it was with a wheelchair. But the point is to allow them to bring their grandchildren to their homeland, their original homeland. So whether you came from Italy or you came from Germany or France or Pakistan or South Africa, the idea was to bring people back home so that you could teach your youngsters, the grandchildren, where they came from and part of their heritage. And that was what I did. And I didn't sell it under my name. It was sold through American Express and many other companies. And because of that, I also became an expert on knowing how to bring in, that's how I got into politics. I knew how to be able to bring people who were like in LA and wanted to see family that was dying or ill in Iran. And I was able to traverse through Turkey across the border into Iran, and nobody was the wiser, and was able to bring them back home the same way.
Tell me something, if I may reverse this on you. When you were, I mean, I traveled all over the world on business, but not as extensively as you have. I'll put it this way. The country, that the way it ran and the way the lifestyle was, that surprised you the most. That was a much more pleasant place than perhaps you thought, or a more interesting place.
Well, you know, it was interesting. Actually, I had a moment. And that moment was when I actually went to Karachi. And I speak German fluently. And the plane landed in Frankfurt, and there was a 6-hour layover. And I walked out of the airport, you know, thinking nothing about it. So, okay, so here I am in Germany, big deal. And then I was walking around, and at every corner, it scared me to death. What the hell was driving me insane mentally? I don't know. My mother was born in Berlin, and she never wanted to go back at all. And I was there, and I was scared that at every corner, I guess a Nazi would come. It was like totally insane. And it actually changed my understanding of the crisis that happened in World War II. I can't forgive what happened, but I can appreciate that not only did Jews suffer, they suffered in the death camps and they were killed because of bigotry, but at the same time, there were many people who were not Jewish, who were of German descent, who ended up suffering because they were forced into they were incarcerated into the military. You think that people wanted to do what they did? I don't think so. There's a lot of denial, even to this day, but that's not the fault of the dynamic. My problem was overcoming an anger or a hatred. I never really had hatred for the Germans, and I happen to love them. Not in a ridiculous way. It's just I respect them. I respect the country. I respect how they've evolved from World War II to the present, because I've only lived from 1950 on. And I was fed the legacy that my parents taught me. So I know the travesty of Poland very well, and I know the travesty of Germany very well, and I've been to these countries. And
have you spent more time in Germany?
That's the problem.
Over the years? Have you spent more time in Germany over the years?
In fact, I kept on asking, well, when my father was alive, I asked him, do you want to go back to Poland to see what it was like? He refused. He was an obstinate sort of guy, but I understood him, and it wasn't in a negative way. It was too hard for him to contemplate. He couldn't go back. It was just too terrifying, and he shared that with me through my life. So I was aware of it. And
what
my mother,
Poland,
though,
was he? Did he come from?
A city called Łódź, L-O-D-Z is the way they spell it. Very wealthy people, extremely wealthy. They had a general store in Łódź that was the size of Gimbel's or Macy's.
My goodness.
My father was the only Jewish guy when there was a royalty in Poland. There was a prince and a king of Poland. And mm-hmm. my father was the only one of the same age as the prince of Poland. He was the only Jew that went skiing with the prince, and at the same time with other people that went to the university. My father also went to university. And the point is that they traveled together as skiers. They traveled all over the world. Mm. And it was very, but that all went to asunder. And I think my father could never overcome the loss of their wealth because everything was robbed from them, and that was it. But that was my father. My mother, I kept on saying, "Hey, would you like to go? Would you like to go?" And she eventually said, "Yeah, she'd like to go." And I went to see her apartment where they lived, and across the street was where in Berlin. It was at one time it was East Germany. So when the wall came down,
you're going to say in Eastern. Okay,
said,
yes, go ahead.
Exactly, the Eastern Charlottenburg. That was the area, very, very high end now. It was always even then, but it resuscitated with younger people. And mm-hmm. so we went there. And so right across where she lived was her high school. And when we went there, she says, "It looks so small." And that's because she had grown taller. So when she was there, she was shorter. And then right about a half a block away was the major synagogue, and it was never bombed at all by the Germans. And interestingly enough, when we went to see where some of her relatives had passed away, were buried before the war, that too was not bombed.
Do you know, there's an interesting, go back to your father for a moment, Hezzy. You know, in Schindler's List, which I understand you have to compact a lot of history into 2 hours, but
sure.
There's a scene there where they tried to capture that a lot of the native Poles, or Polish ethnicity, Polish Christians, that mm-hmm. they didn't like the Jews either. And there's the scene where the little girl, where the guy gets ratted out in the hallway, there's a Jew in the house. And then later on, the way the director decided to deal with it was have that little girl in the street while people were being moved to the ghetto saying, "Goodbye, Jews." Mm-hmm. "Goodbye, Jews." How prevalent was that? Was anti-Semitism incipient?
But it wasn't just in Poland. It wasn't in Poland. It was all over Europe.
Oh, no, I know that. But it was, okay, it was all, of course it was all over Europe. I mean,
it was all over Europe.
Years, and
you think,
thrown
you think,
out of,
yeah, but you
out
think
of
things have changed all that much? Things haven't changed all that much.
That's what I mean.
You go to America. You know, American Jewry is unaware even of their own history. There was a time in the 1950s where you would go down south, and the only people, you weren't allowed to go into a men's room. You weren't allowed to drink from a fountain if you were a Jew. Same problem if you were black. And the only place you could drink was where the dogs drank from. And that was all. I told you so.
This is in
absolutely in the 1950s on. Yeah. Absolutely. And but most people are unaware of it. And that's the thing that's compelling, that the history is gone. It doesn't matter what happened in the 1950s. Maybe to a Jew it matters. Maybe to an African-American it matters. And it informs them of where we are today. But that's an evolution. And you have to be thankful that America was able to evolve beyond where it was. If you go to the Soviet Union today, you got similar issues than you had before the war. But, you know, people don't see that.
Well, I do. I totally understand where you're coming from with that. In fact, that's one of the issues that we don't, I think, accept as well as you've articulated, which is that we are evolving. We're not where we should be, but we do make progress. My concern is that people who don't know history on two levels, yes, you should condemn it, but you can't erase it. And one needs to see where we've come from how we've evolved.
You said before we were going blue, which is correct. We are going blue. However, the point is that the history of what happened in the United States under the Trump administration and what I can't find another word other than insurrection. And the problem is that up to now the argument has been adversarial rather than factual. It's all based on opinion and conceptualization. However, now as we are arriving at a point of getting the facts and people speaking up because they don't feel insecure about telling it the way it is, then we're going to find out what the facts are. And that will inform people of what happened then, what's happening now, and will inform us what to do next time there's an election. And all these things matter. And anyone who's ignorant and unaware is hurting themselves. And when you look at the landscape and you say, well, these people aren't moving ahead, because you people are not moving ahead. You're not involved. You're not engaged. I'm sorry. Even if major corporations are going to spend $1 million on a campaign, why are you so stupid, not you personally or anybody in particular, why is the voter so stupid to believe in whatever the BS is in the advertisement when they know it's not happening? So why are they buying into that? Because at the end of the day, it's not the money that's spent to advertise to people in order to buy their vote that way through influence, but actually the voter himself or herself is able to cast their own vote. And that could expunge literally $1 million worth of advertising money right then and there. And that's what people don't comprehend. And we don't comprehend that because we don't speak about it.
Well, you're speaking about it now, but how do we realistically, you and I have done, each of us now, maybe the last 20, 25 years of our life has been spent journalism. And right. It works both ways. A, because we do that, we read a lot because we have to read a lot. But prior to that, those were likely yours as mine. Those were our proclivities anyway. How do we get the general public to get, because the people that seek voters know this. And so they lie on both sides and they dissemble and they use marketing
techniques. Our teaching is languishing. Our schools are not doing their job. Time when you would be able to hear a group of intellectual wizards, the best of the best from Harvard or from Yale or from wherever you want, or even from a local college, and they would be given a task, and the task is to argue one side of an argument. A half hour or an hour later,
yep,
switched, and what you did in A, you now had to do what you
yep.
had to. You had to vouch for the B side of the
yeah.
equation.
I did
and the
it,
B
it
side
a
ended up taking
it
on your
high
A.
School, I got
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. Why did we drop it? Because that showed one, any individual, that not only is there a lucidity to a particular perspective, but there's also validation from both sides of the equation. So mentally,
yes.
you could decipher both. you could agree with both and you could disagree with both. But you found out that you have the capacity to contemplate both issues.
Mm-hmm.
It's not white, it's not black, it's somewhere in the middle and or somewhere along that spectrum. And it doesn't matter where in the spectrum you are, but you're more informed. You now know that there is more to what you didn't know.
Now, you know, one of my beefs with the far left and mm-hmm. is rather than beef up education for poor or racial groups that haven't had opportunity, they want to change the standards instead. And it's lowering the bar.
Yeah, but
this
is not going to help people. This is a democracy. We don't have an autocracy that's going to tell us what we need to do, whether we like it or not.
I understand.
This is
that,
the nation that we're in, and the nation must fight for its position.
Well, yes, but my point is, sir, that my point of view, as center-left it has been most of my adult life, is that you can, if you lower the bar for education, it's not going to help people down the road. They're not going to get better jobs. They're not going to become more informed. And I put a stake in the ground.
It's not for them to become more informed. We have to teach them, hey, there's a curriculum. Well, that's it. So the point is that as an adult representing your child in a school, then you need to go out there and advocate for your child. Like, for example, we used to have 27,000 kids in the city of Yonkers. You couldn't even get 25. You couldn't get 25 parents to go and demonstrate or advocate, not necessarily advocate, but advocate for their own children.
Advocate for the right thing? What about when a parent is advocating, that test is unfair, my son can't add. Here, go. Push him through to the next level anyway for political reasons.
Well, if your son can't add, then maybe you need to go there and help your son who doesn't understand the mathematics.
Well,
and if you don't understand it, you can get help. And you can get help through the school.
You're absolutely right, but it's a democracy, and I understand that. I love democracy. It's why I'm so upset these days.
If you come to me and you need help with mathematics, I'm not that obtuse, and I'll be able to help. Just ask me. I'll do it.
Democracy is not, though, cannot within itself change a fact. Democracy shouldn't be allowed to change facts.
Democracy is not changing the fact, but the teaching institution needs to be aware and sensitive to where they're failing. And if they can't get it on their own, then you should get rid of the boards of education and fire these idiots who just get a lot of money but don't produce.
I agree.
And the production
is your student population. We're arguing the same point.
Yeah. Anyway, for some reason we've overspent our time. I didn't realize it because I didn't get a call from our last caller, so I'm going to try to call him. So forgive me, but thank you for a scintillating conversation.
Thank you very much.
I love you and
best.
Hate you at the same time.
You know, I love and hate you with a deep, intense passion. God
bless
you, Harrison.
Thank you for the time. Take care.
You be well.
Bye. Okay, let's see if we can get a hold of Delphi Musla, because for some crazy reason, maybe he doesn't have the number. Maybe he doesn't have the number for the radio show, and that's not good, even though we do send out a notice by email to advise people how to call. So, unfortunately, it's like 21 minutes before the hour. Let me see if I could find him. One second. Okay, I think I found his number. Let me see if we can call him. Hopefully he'll be able to pick up. Hope everything is all right. It's just a question of him not knowing the phone number. One second. All right, let's see what happens. At least it's a ringy-dingy.
Hello?
Hi, Delphin. I thought that you would call us, but I guess you didn't have the number for the radio show?
No, I didn't. No, sorry.
No problem. Anyway, I'm sorry to call so late. I got wound up by my past guest. So we only have about 20 minutes left, but hopefully we'll be able to continue this into the future as well. So first of all,
okay.
I should advise people you're the publisher and editor of Yonkers Insider. So tell us a little bit about Delphin Musler and Yonkers Insider, because you've been around many, many years. I think you originated Yonkers Insider before I even got into the scene, and I'm only at it about 22 years. So you started before I did.
Yeah, it's been a long ride, and it just gets so exciting, you know, covering the news each and every day, and always seeing different news, being able to put different news out there and everything. It really is exciting, and very I'm very passionate about covering the news, and because I feel it's a way of giving back to my city, the city and county I love so much, and just love doing it, cover all kinds of stuff. You know, I obviously cover the community events, also cover government, also cover the politics. So it's just been a tremendous time, and like I say, I've always been passionate, but it's really made me feel younger in a lot of respects, I think, in a lot of ways, because all so much to do in terms of news reporting.
Well, absolutely, you know, with all the news that's coming out, it keeps you mentally supple, because you need to be able to appreciate and understand what's going on. Do you find that in the last 25 years, since you got started, has there been an evolution in the type of reporting that takes place? Is it because government is more open, or they're just as closed, but the public is somehow more engaged than ever before? And in order to meet the demands of the public, we're also feeding them more information that they are in search of. How do you see things?
I think there has been evolution due to social media. I think social media has really excavated the evolution, I think, in a lot of ways, in a lot of respects. You see a lot more digital reporting than printed paper reporting these days.
Well, the print is definitely not doing so well. Well, about 3 or 4 weeks ago, the Journal News didn't print for 2 days. About a week or two later, they didn't print again for 2 days. And then about a week or a week and a half ago, they said that they would stop printing on Saturday. And they cover 5 counties. And I don't know if I'm concerned, but I find it compelling to hear that they can't seem to get their act together. But then again, you're very local. You're hyper-local. You talk about stuff that happens here. I believe that I do as well. And and sometimes beyond the city of Yonkers, I try to cover a little bit more. But that's neither here nor there. But the point is, the Journal News has not been covering local stuff. So why would anybody, even in Yonkers, the third largest city in the state, bother to read the Journal News if there's nothing there? I don't quite agree with you. Maybe with regard to social media, it caused more people to get online, but I don't think that social media is a political or news item. I don't think that they gain that clout, because I don't believe that people watch social media like a Facebook, or even video on Facebook, where there's a lot of interest in that, and that may not be the fault of social media, but just the fact that during the day and even at night, we're busy working, whoever we are, and you don't have the time to sit there and listen to a half hour show on television, because you need to view and see at the same time, you know. So you're viewing and hearing more at the same time. But like on radio, you can listen in the background.
That's true. No, that's true. Also, absolutely.
So anyway, I'm not moving on to the online Facebook. So whatever. So Is there anything that you find in the city of Yonkers that is very pertinent or that has struck you as very important of late?
I think obviously we have a new city council majority of it, so interesting to see where she'll take her leadership skills in terms of Tasha Diaz becoming a new Yonkers city council majority leader to see where the city council moves forward. Also, obviously, we have a new council president, Lakeisha Collins, telling me as well. So, I mean, it'd be interesting to see where the city council will be headed in this upcoming year.
Well, I don't have much hope for Tasha Diaz, who's the majority leader. She's very arrogant. She's very belligerent in her tone and in her physical presence. And she frightens people, and she gets into arguments with people. So I don't see how the majority leader can, under her aegis, under her guidance, is going to be able to manage the Democratic majority of 5-2. I don't see it. I
absolutely agree with you. No, absolutely. Yeah.
And she has, you know, the most telling thing to me is she was mm-hmm. made, she was given the portfolio for education. That was her job. Isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
That was her only job other than being a city council person. Her responsibility was education. She knows nothing about education. She never held one committee meeting on education. So what does that tell me? It tells me either she's lazy or stupid. It's one or the other, but you can't escape
mm-hmm.
that. Her responsibility was education, and she has failed on education alone. And you know what?
That's true. Absolutely.
Not everyone needs to get a college degree or a degree in anything. You know, when you come of age after a point, and we all get educated by life, and we also therefore know what we're missing or what we're languishing in knowing, and if it's a responsibility and you're elevated to a particular task, then you have to say to yourself, well, I could take on the challenge and I need to study it, or because I don't have an option of saying, well, I'll see you in 3 months after I study it more. So, okay, fine, you got an opportunity to do it. But in 3 months' time, you don't think you can get enough information to know what the hell's going on with the Board of Education? I mean, really, we lost close to 3,000 to 4,000 kids in the last year alone. Where did they go? They didn't drop out of school. They went to other schools, Catholic schools, private schools, special schools, whatever. You know,
mm-hmm.
what has she been doing the last year? I don't get it. I don't see it.
Absolutely, no. It is absolutely true. I absolutely agree with you. There's a lot of concerns I have with her becoming majority leader too, because she really hasn't brought anything to the floor in terms of a council member in her time on the council as well. So it really are some major, major questions. Plus, what I can say about her temperament and her demeanor and everything really does raise some serious issues, I think, a little bit.
Well, I think so, because I think the majority leader needs to be someone that can bring people together.
Yes,
and
that's true.
Even though there are 5 Democrats and only 2 Republicans, there need not be a political divide on issues that actually overlay the political side of the equation. So whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, education matters. And
that's
we're
true.
Not talking about agenda. We're just talking about what do we do? Do we have enough funding for our schools? Are we taking care of it? Are we supplying computers for the kids when they have to do remote learning? I know Dr. Quezada last year said he ordered 5,000 Chromebooks, never arrived because he never ordered.
Mm-hmm.
But he said he did, but he never delivered, which means that he never ordered. Or maybe the money's stuck somewhere. So I wonder really where the money is.
That's a good point. No, it's true, yes.
You know, but I'm never going to get an answer from Dr. Quezada. Thank God I don't talk to him. I would just go crazy talking to him. Because I would teach him what it means to be a superintendent of schools, which he evidently doesn't know. Ah, unbelievable.
You know,
a lot of stuff that goes on because it's really unbelievable. I think a lot of stuff has, you know, I absolutely agree with you.
Well, they hide a lot of stuff, you know. It's not.
That's
not
true, yes.
You know, mm-hmm. The Board of Education under Quezada, do you know that 30% of the kids were infected last year?
Mm-hmm.
30%.
Mm-hmm.
That's irrational. Why
it is,
that?
Yes.
And not a word from anybody. Not a word. And you think we don't have that same problem with some of our people in the fire department and police department? I don't know what the percentages are because you don't hear anything from them. Either one. So, whatever. But I love Yonkers, and I'm thrilled. You know what I'm really thrilled about the most? I'm thrilled about Lionsgate. Lionsgate, under Mayor Spano, when he fired this guy, Peachy, who was supposed to pass the paperwork, and it was languishing under his watch. He was the engineer for the city. He held things up. The mayor confronted him and said, "What's going on?" And then he said something to the effect of, "Well, if you don't like my work, you could fire me." So thank goodness the mayor had the balls and the brains to say, "Well, you're fired. See ya. Don't take the car. Get somebody else to pick you up," which was terrific. And then about a month or so later, everything was resolved. They opened up, not a problem, not an issue. And that's going to change the dynamic for Yonkers. It adds a layer of exceptionalism that mm-hmm. separates the city, the third largest city in the state, from New York, because with Lionsgate, they have the facility, bigger equipment, newer equipment, cutting edge, and also the rates are cheaper. It's gonna give a New York City a run for its money.
Mm-hmm. I absolutely agree. No, that's true. Yes, absolutely.
What do you think about MGM? MGM looks like it may be one of the winners of the capacity to have online betting through the internet. So I think they got one of the licenses, and they're already online. I think yesterday or maybe last week, I don't know, but you're online, you could actually bet. I don't have enough money to bet, though. And so can I admit that on radio? I would be afraid to lose it all. I work too hard for it. I'm not a
Me too in a lot of ways. No, that is true also. Me too. I absolutely agree myself, too. Yeah, I would absolutely be afraid of losing all the money and everything.
Exactly. I'm not even going to bet $5, you know, because it's not a, there is no such thing as a sure thing when it comes to betting. I remember once going to a casino in Paraguay of all places, and actually I played, but I actually won there, and then I had the bug for it when I once went to the Bahamas, and I lost there, so I said, well, stupid move on my part, so never again.
Oh,
it cost too much. So what are you working on? Any particular stories that you're looking into, or do you pay a lot of attention to the development?
Starting to pay attention to the upcoming 2022 election, starting to delve in to see some of the candidates who are coming forward, you know, coming forward very slowly this year, but you know, they're coming forward. So I'm trying to do stories on that in terms of the upcoming elections. Also, I'm in the middle of an expansion. I have had the Yonkers Insider site, but now I'm actually expanding it now, where I'm able to where I've created about 23 more sites to cover all different ports, all different communities in Westchester to do a report on even a greater scale than I have done in the past.
So. How do you reach your website online?
It'll be www.yonkersinsider.blogspot.com, and then also there's links on my site to all my other new sites as well.
So you could also just look up in case you don't remember the email the web address. You could just look up Yonkers Insider, and that will take you there too, right?
Yes,
okay.
Absolutely.
Well, that's
yes,
very important.
Well, much success in your venture. That's really wonderful.
Thank you so much. Always nice to be on your show with you, Hezzy. Thank you so much, and I absolutely look forward to coming on weekly on your show, and so we can discuss the news.
Yeah, most definitely. Anything else that you're on? Because we've got another 5 minutes left if you want to.
Nothing really at this point. You know, I think I'll start to get busy now because once we get towards the beginning of the new year and everything, and especially we have an earlier election calendar like we've had in the past. So I think things will start to pick up, I think, in a lot of ways.
Oh, I'm sure. Are they picking up right now already?
A little bit. You're seeing dribs and drabs, or maybe some different candidates coming forward and everything. But like I say, as February comes, things will start to pick up. I think a little better. I think in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Well, people are going to announce that they're candidates. Some are already have. There's some people running on Westchester County for. Well, they're running for county executive, not county executive, but county board of Westchester County Board of Legislators. There are already people running for particular offices, and also people rising up to even higher levels. Sandy Galick, she's not going to be running. So she announced she's not running. So that's already in contention. We got the former mayor of Peekskill, Rainey is his last name, and he's running for that seat. And Dana Levenberg, she's the mayor of the town of Ossining, and she's also declared that she's running. So you've got a lot on your plate to try to cover all.
Yes, no, it's true. And also in that race, you got Westchester County Legislator Colin Smith just announced his candidacy for that seat as well. So that seat could have a lot of candidates. He's running for Sandy Gale's seat.
Oh, he is? Really?
Yes, he is.
No, I didn't hear that.
He just announced on Sunday.
Okay, I didn't get the message from him, so I just didn't notice it. Or maybe it's in my email, but it doesn't matter. Also, it's already really quite contentious. Well, it's hard to replace Sandy Galick. She has.
That's true. I absolutely agree. She's an institution. Yes, that's true.
Well, it's interesting because Sandy Galick Levenberg used to work for her as her communication officer. Rainey, I only know him from, I don't know him very well at all. I never heard of him, but he's from Peekskill. And what about Collins? What's he doing? What does he bring to the equation?
He's a Westchester County legislator. He represents District 1. I think he's in his second term on the County Legislature now.
And where does he cover?
Peekskill, Cortland, and Yorktown.
Oh, okay. So then that's the area. Okay, very good. All right. Well, did you cover what's going on in Yorktown recently?
Yes.
Okay.
Hello.
Well, because they're very progressive there in building.
They are.
Development. It's very exciting. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I'll let you go.
Thank you so much, Hezzy, and I look forward to being on your show again next week. Thanks so much for the opportunity, and we'll talk next week. And have yourself a great day, Hezzy.
You too. All the best, Delphi Musler.
He's the
publisher and editor of Yonkers Insider. You can find him online at Yonkers Insider by looking it up. And what do you say? The address was Yonkers Insider. blogspot.com. But you'll find it better by just simply going through the browser and looking for Yonkers Insider. Take care, folks. That's the end of our time with you today. Tomorrow, let me see if I have enough time to tell you what's going on tomorrow. Tomorrow we're going to speak to Dr. Nader Sayers. the New York State Assembly member representing Yonkers District 30, District 90, forgive me. Take care and goodbye.